This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. Since the beginning of the Great Recession, we've been meeting quarterly with Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast, based out of UNC Charlotte. In previous conversations, Dr. Connaughton predicted that 2014 would be a breakout year for North Carolina's economy. Welcome news after some very painful years of recession. The national economy seems to be following that prediction after an unfortunate first quarter, which was held back by the weather, they say. Recent jobs numbers indicate that people are going back to work, and the stock market is soaring into record territory. So how is North Carolina doing? Does the picture continue to be hopeful? Let's find out, and welcome back John Connaughton, who broke his vacation to be with us on this program today. Welcome back from wherever it is you go.
Thank you, Mike. It's good to be here.
Let's start with some national statistics. Unemployment is down. Allegedly, we have regained all of the jobs lost during the Great Recession nationally. Is that true?
That's true. Unemployment rate 6.1%. Last month, we got all the jobs back that we had lost. We had lost 8.7 million jobs during that recession. We got them all back. So now we are where we were in December of 2007. So it's taken 6.5 years, basically, to get all those lost jobs back, but they are back now.
Is that true in North Carolina?
Not quite. We've gotten about 85% of the jobs back. We lost a little over 330,000, and we've gotten about 280 back. We should reach that threshold either very late this year or very early next year. So we're probably 6 months away.
So why doesn't it feel like it felt in 2006?
It's a great question. And that's been the big issue that's been, I think, troubling people for the last 4 years since the recovery actually began. Mm-hmm. It just doesn't feel like a recovery. And they're right. It hasn't. And there are a variety of reasons why. For one, we really haven't had that. They talked about this in the past. They used to talk about this deep V recession where you had a big drop and then you had a big return. We can remember back in some of the recoveries in the 1980s out of the 82 recession. Mm-hmm. One month, we actually created a million jobs in 1 month. And now we're looking at 200,000 is a good number in job creation. So we don't have those types of deep Vs. We got the downside of it, the big drop that we got in 2008 as a result of the financial crisis. But the recovery hasn't been the upside of it. It's been a very, very slow recovery, both in terms of jobs, but also in terms of output. The GDP numbers haven't been, 5-6% growth rates for a quarter or two in a row.
And these jobs that have been created, the jobs that have replaced all the jobs that we lost, what kinds of jobs are they and what kind of money do they pay?
Okay, there has been somewhat of a mismatch in terms of the types of jobs that were lost versus the types of jobs that are coming back. And this is really where there's kind of a structural problem that's probably not going to go away in this generation. We lost, of the 8.7 million we lost, almost half of those were in manufacturing and construction. So you consider those blue-collar jobs, good wage jobs, however, in manufacturing and construction, middle-income jobs. Those we lost. We haven't gained more than about 500,000 of those 4+ million jobs back in this cycle. So, yeah, we got all 8.7 million jobs back. But of those blue-collar jobs, we only got 500,000 of the over 4 million that we lost. So there's a big gap there for those folks.
Why is that?
Well, for two reasons. And it's different depending on whether it's construction or manufacturing. On the construction side, which has been the weakest in terms of recovery, it's simply been because we overbuilt. We had way too many people employed in that industry because of the overbuilding caused by the funky mortgages that we've all heard about over the past 4 or 5 years as they've been litigated through the courts. So we had too many people employed in that industry anyway. Secondly, because of all of the distressed properties that were out there after the foreclosures, basically, we haven't built very many houses. And so, all those jobs just haven't come back. We thought, and there's still some hope, that we're having somewhat of a housing recovery. Didn't look that way in the first quarter. We can talk about some details as to what went on in the first quarter in a minute. But certainly housing suffered in the first quarter, probably because of weather. But, even if it even if it comes true, even if we have a continuation of the growth in the housing industry this year and next year, it's not going to be at those levels we had before. So that's what's going on in construction. The 2 million jobs we lost there, we probably won't get – we'll get less than half of those back long term. In manufacturing, it's a different story. In manufacturing, what happened – and this happens in every single recession – it exacerbates the structural change, the technology march, if you will, of replacing – workers with machines. And so what happens is that when you have a decline in manufacturing employment, you shut down in manufacturing output, you shut down the plants that are the least efficient plants. Those don't get opened back up again. The jobs are added slowly at the most efficient plants, which are the ones with the most technology and need the fewest workers. So, you know, those manufacturing jobs that we lost, those 2.2 million manufacturing jobs, we've gotten about 500,000 of those back nationally. We may get a few more of those back, but we've probably hit a plateau in manufacturing employment.
I wasn't planning to talk about this today, but there was an article in the paper, I think the New York Times this morning, about the head of Google saying that he thinks we should all work less, that we should all work part-time, that 21 hours a week would be a good number, and that we should all make a decent amount of money for that part-time work. Not unlike, I think it was an experiment in the 80s or 90s in some place somewhere in the world where everybody got a base salary for the 21 or 25 or 30 hours that they worked, and you know, you went off and had a good time with yourself. That sounds complete. This guy's worth $26 billion, so it's easy for him to say that we should all work
part-time. So if he worked half-time, he'd be worth $13 billion.
Right.
So
he could still have a nice dinner.
I can see where that would work out for him. Yeah.
So is that even remotely sustainable?
No, it's not. And I mean, the reason is...
What's wrong with this guy?
What's wrong with this picture? Okay, here's what's going on. I mean, most of us probably don't feel this way. But the reality is we are paid the value of what we call our marginal product. That's an econ term. Sorry about that. But it basically means we're paid for what we produce. Okay? Now, if we can become much more productive, produce more per hour,
right,
then we could work fewer hours and still make the same amount of dollars. Mm-hmm. But when you look at the productivity gains – for the economy as a whole, and right now they're pretty stagnant, but historically they run in the 1.5 to 2% per year range. You can do the math on that. It's really very simple algebra. In order for us to become twice as productive at a 2% growth rate in our productivity, okay, we can apply something called the rule of 72. We don't have to worry about that, but I'll give you the answer. It's about 30 years, 35 years for me, you, and most every other American to become twice as productive on average, mm-hmm. as they were. So it's to 35 years. Then at that point in time, you know, we could make as much money working 20 hours 35 years from now as we did making working 40 hours today. That's a long period of time.
You're close to retirement.
You're pretty close to retirement. More importantly, most folks, uh-huh. when they are confronted with make more money, work a few more hours, most people go ahead and make that choice. Now, you know, I don't think there's this big push from the 37.5-hour, 40-hour work week, whatever you want to call it today. I think most people would be very comfortable with that. Maybe we don't even want to get into what happens when you work less than 20, 30 hours and responsibilities for health care and things like that.
Well, I think that what triggered that question, aside from the fact that I read the article this morning, was the fact that you're talking about how this shift, when we have a recession, there are fewer jobs in manufacturing because they find ways to use technology to replace human beings. And the people at Google are trying to replace us as drivers of our cars. You don't need librarians anymore because their search engine will bring up anything in a split second, blah, blah, blah. So is he kind of preparing us for a new world where we won't work because there simply won't be jobs?
That's the science fiction plan out there that, you know, the George Jetson era. Uh-huh. But
although he worked at Spacely Sprockets.
Yeah, I understand that, but he didn't work very hard at Spacely. Okay. But my point is this, that, you know, we always think that technology is always going to replace people, and it will replace those jobs that the technology replaces. It absolutely will. But there will be other jobs that will be created as a result of this. Mm-hmm. Somebody's got to make those machines. Somebody's got to design those machines, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And so the history of technological advancement has been short-term dislocation of jobs, long-term growth of jobs. I mean, today we employ more people in this country than we ever have in the history of this country. So there are more people working today than there have been at any other time in this country, period. So despite the fact that we've had technological advance and productivity gains,
based on per capita population or just more people? Because there are more people here than there ever been before.
Actually, no. The population is actually pretty darn stagnant right now, okay. Particularly the working age population. We can talk about that later. But in real terms, there are more people working today than there ever have been in the country. Now, we can quibble about the quality of those jobs. There's no question about that. However, in terms of technology getting rid of jobs, individuals get hurt when if you're a taxi driver and all of a sudden Google produces their Google card can pick you up and deposit you wherever you need to deposit without a driver. Taxi drivers will lose their jobs. Right. They will be hurt. There will be a burden on them. But as a result of that, somebody's got to program that car. Somebody's got to make that car. Somebody's got to keep that car on the road somewhere. And so other jobs get created as a result of that.
And somebody has to give that car a ticket when it speeds.
Yeah.
All right. The stock market has been soaring now for months. It reached record highs twice in a row until yesterday when it kind of dipped 100 points and fell below the magic mark of 1,700.
17,000.
17,000, where it had never been before. Is this really a good sign?
Well, never to look at the stock market is really a leading indicator of what's going on. It does give you some indication as to the confidence that investors have in business in general. And certainly the stock market has been on a ride. But remember, before the great big crash, you know, it wasn't up to 17,000, but it was pretty high, and it took a big hit, and it's been clawing its way back. Mm-hmm. And it's only been the last year and a half or so that it's actually exceeded its pre-recession high.
But given the fact that we don't feel like we're in a recovery.
But a lot of things lead to why dollars – I mean, it's just simple, the price of stocks is simply supply and demand.
All right.
And if more people are demanding stocks than are providing stocks for sale – prices rise for stocks. It's just that simple. And that's what we see happening here. Two things are going on. One, businesses are doing fairly well in this economic environment. It's a slow growth environment. We can talk about that later as to what those causes are, but it is a slow growth environment. But businesses have figured out how to adapt and be profitable in that. So we're not sitting here in a situation where we've got this bubble, and like we've had in the past.
So this is not irrational exuberance.
This is not irrational exuberance. There is some fundamentals underneath those stock prices. Having said that, however, we do have to realize that there is no other place to put your money as an investor. Bonds are paying 2.5-3% at best these days. Money markets, et cetera, we all know how bad those are paying. Less than 1%. If you're lucky, you can get 1%, 1.25%, something like that. So there isn't a lot of other alternatives. So as a result of the Fed policy over the past 6 years of keeping interest rates really, really low to try to stimulate the economy, the stock market has been one option where you can put money to try to get a return better than 1%.
And although these roaring stock markets always face corrections, which you think will happen, you don't see any reason for this to ease off severely in the near future.
No, there probably will be a correction. There typically is in the fall. There's maybe a 5-10% correction. I don't consider that to be a big deal.
Mm-hmm.
But in terms of long term, the slow growth economy is going to cause the Fed to continue this low interest rate policy for quite some time.
Dr. John Connaughton, director of the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast. We're coming right back to talk about the state in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Heath Springs Residential Care Center, providing family-oriented long-term assisted living for the elderly in historic Heath Springs, South Carolina. Privately owned for 20-plus years, 803-273-3227. Well, how do you improve the quality of life in a city? Well, in Charlotte, you hold a series of meetings with citizens to find out what they want. And then you figure out ways to turn those desires into public policy. That, in a nutshell, is what has happened as a result of the Mecklenburg Livable Communities Initiative. And now, Mecklenburg County in Charlotte and the surrounding towns are taking information from citizen meetings to make the region a better place to live, work, and play. And we'll find out how tomorrow at 9.
On the next Day and Ream Show, advocates for smart guns, which can be fired only by their owners, argue the technology could reduce gun violence. But the NRA and other gun rights advocates call it gun control. Why smart guns are not for sale in the U.S.
That's the Day and Ream Show this morning from 10 to noon after Charlotte Talks on 90.7 WFAE.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. Dr. John Condon, economist at UNC Charlotte and the director of the state's economic forecast, the Babson Capital North Carolina Economic Forecast, is with us and has been stopping by on a quarterly basis since everything went to heck in a handbasket in 2007.
Yeah. I just wanted to follow up on just before the break and try to explain that, you know, with two things are going to be going on in the near term. And that is that federal government expenditures are probably going to be continued to be pared over the next couple of years. And so, you know, fiscal policy is going to be inept at trying to put some juice into the economy and push it past a 2% growth. And with the new Fed chairman, Janet Yellen, I think that she is a fairly easy monetary policy school of thought. And I think that she will continue to keep rates low longer than they have promised to keep rates low.
Which will be good for the economy, or good for the recovery, bad for investors?
I think that what will happen is that you'll have a very easy transition from this low interest rate environment to a set of rising interest rates, so it won't destabilize the stock market as, you know, causing a lot of money to get pulled out quickly looking for fixed investments.
Now, in previous visits, when we've talked about this state's economy, you've said that 2014 should prove to be a breakout year for the state. We're halfway through. Is that proving to be true?
Well, look, we had a really bad first quarter nationally, and that will be true here in North Carolina when the data finally come in, which will be in a couple weeks. We get a good look at it. At first, we thought it was a flat quarter, like down 0.1% in GDP. Then it turns out that after a couple of revisions and more data coming in, it was down 2.9%. And when you look at why it was down, that's what's disconcerting. So overall, GDP dropped by 2.9% in the first quarter. But when you look at the components, you see that the two big drops, the two things causing that, is number one, investment in structures, residential and commercial structures, that was down almost a little over 11%, and that's a big drop. Now that could have been weather related to some extent, simply because, you know, the weather just didn't allow, particularly in the northern United States, a lot of building to take place during that first quarter. Right. But I think it's a little bit deeper than that. I think that there was a buildup at the end of last year in housing, and it may have slacked off in the winter. Whether that's a long-term trend or not, we really can't tell. So we've kind of got to wait for a couple more quarters of data to come in on this, on the residential construction side of things. The second area that was down, which was a kind of a shock, was exports. And they were down considerably. And as a result of that, you know, you're looking at exports being down. That's really, in terms of our exports, so many of those go to Europe, such a large percentage go to Europe. That's really what we're looking at there, is what's going on in the European economy. And there's no quick fixes there. I mean, there.
And that's something we can't control. And yet, it seems to me you could look at it.
And you've got half of Europe in terms of trying to rein in budgets and stuff like that, and, you know, really kind of put a clamp, if you will, on the growth of the economy. And you got the other half of Europe thinking, well, maybe we should. I mean, you've got some parts of Europe lowering interest rates. You've got Britain raising interest rates because they're having a housing bubble in London.
Right.
And so you've got this kind of a mixed bag of what's going on there.
But you said we thought it was a flat quarter, and it was down 2.9%, which came as kind of a surprise.
Yet,
but don't we look, don't economists here look at the economy in Europe, the economy in China, the economy in the rest of Asia, and say, well, they're not doing well, so maybe the first quarter won't be so great?
Yeah.
Yeah? We just didn't see it?
Yeah.
Okay. In your latest report, you say that the economic signs here are pointing to a slowdown in the state's economy. When did those signs first begin to rear their ugly heads?
Well, when we saw the first quarter of
okay.
that came, that came out of the blue. I mean, everybody thought it would be kind of a flat, we'd lose some of the steam because of the weather. But I don't think anyone had any idea that it would be that slow. Now, there are some, there's always some outliers that are saying, the next doomsday is right around the corner,
right.
Kind of like the old laugh-in thing. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, this was unforeseen. Now, the question is it, the trend? Are we going to have a really slow year, or are we just going to have a moderately slow year where we see growth pick up in the second and third quarter to that 2% range? And so we just kind of have a flat 2-2.5% growth rate this year overall.
Well, you anticipated growth to be 2% in the first and third quarter of this year with slight improvement of 2.1% in the second quarter and 2.3% in the fourth quarter.
Yeah, not great.
No, but do you still see those numbers?
Those numbers are they're in a little bit of jeopardy for sure, and we'll have a better handle on it in a month or two when we finally get in to some of the second quarter numbers. The one thing that kind of flies in contrast to that 2.9% is last month, June, mm-hmm. We created almost 300,000 jobs in the country. And so far this year, we're on target for, 55, 60,000 jobs in the state. So there's, we are generating those jobs, and so it's kind of, again, consumer purchases were up in the first quarter. So U.S. consumers, and again, that's 70% of the economy, purchases of goods and services domestically was up, 1% in the first quarter. So consumers are still participating. It was just those two components, which are small components,
right.
But they had big drops in them. And if that doesn't continue, if that's not a trend, then I think 2% is a reasonable number for overall for the year's growth.
And one of the things that we have never talked about, I don't think, maybe peripherally, that you want to talk about today, because you see this as a problem in the future, is the aging of the labor force. You say that in the past, when people talked about labor force participation, we've pointed to people who simply have grown weary of unsuccessfully looking for jobs, so they've dropped out of the job market. Now you say the problem is more complicated than that.
Yeah. I think up until about 2012, when we saw the labor force participation rate dropping during this recession, some of that was discourage workers. I don't think there's any question about that. People who simply, dropped out because they couldn't find a job or they couldn't find a job that they were willing to take. I think in the last couple of years, what we're starting to realize is this is the beginning of a longer-term trend. What's interesting is if you look at the long-term labor force participation rate in this country, it went up and up and up and up as a percentage of the working-age population and peaked in the late 1990s, right around 2000, 99, 2000 was the peak, about 68%. It's been dropping ever since then, and it's not been precipitously dropping differently during good times or bad times. It's been pretty stable during both of those periods. And what it basically is, Mike, is it's the aging of the population. It's the baby boomers.
They're retiring.
They are retiring. And here's the strangest thing about that formula. Mm-hmm. This is the thing that kind of shocks people when they hear it. The labor force participation rate, the percentage of working age population that is either working or actively looking for work. That's the labor force participation rate. It's
okay.
That percentage. Mm-hmm. There's no cap on age. So once you hit 16 years old, you're in the working age population. Even if you're 65, 75, 85, you can still work. You're considered part of the working age population. And what's happening is that tail of the, of the working age population that's 65 plus, it's getting bigger and bigger and bigger as the baby boomers move into it, and they are retiring. That's what people do. And well, there's so many of them.
Is this a surprise?
No, it isn't, because these people have been here for a long time.
We knew this was coming. We could point to it.
Yeah, we knew this was coming. But I think, you know, demographers are kind of glacial in their kind of outlook of things. And because they very small changes that take place in populations. They're not rapid, big changes like they are in the economy. You get big swings. What we've got going on right now is that when you look at the groups, and we talk about age cohorts, and they're 5-year groups. So when you look at the group that's right now between 60 and 64, so that's the next group that's over the next 5 years going to phase into retirement. Uh-huh. And then you look at the group that's behind them, mm-hmm. you know, I mean way behind them, that'll be entering the labor force, the 15 to 19-year-olds.
Right.
And you look at the populations in those groups, you say, these old people, there are more of them by about 2 million than there are of the 15 to 19-year-olds. So if you think about that, these are moving out.
Right.
They're still going to be working-age population, but they're not going to be working, okay? And what's moving in will now replace them in the working-age, you know, that's new group. But the problem is it's a smaller group.
Why is that a problem? Because we've already talked about technology reducing the need for people, et cetera, et cetera. So why is that a problem?
Except for one thing. Technology has never reduced the need for people. Okay? For every job it destroys, it creates more than one job.
Okay.
That's been the history of it. Now, maybe we're in for a change. And I know there are lots of folks out there saying, you know, pretty soon – technology will replace even, you know, PhDs and medical doctors, and that may be the case. But again, we've been replacing all kinds of workers that we never thought we would replace. And the end result is for every job that gets destroyed, more than one job gets created somewhere else in some other area of the economy. However, here's where the problem rests. We've gotten used to kind of targeting a 3.5% growth rate for GDP.
Okay.
One of the big components of that is, of course, labor force growth. I mean, the bottom line, Mike, is if you want 3% growth and you got 2% productivity, the other 1% is going to have to come from labor force growth. That's the math of it, or the arithmetic, as Bill Clinton would say.
Mm-hmm.
Well, if all of a sudden you still continue with 2% productivity growth, but the labor force isn't growing,
right?
That means instead of 3 or 3.5%, you're going to be looking at 2.5%.
So does that mean we have to have immigration policy change?
Well, some might suggest that might be one aspect of how you start to deal with that. We are going to start to go through. I mean, they talk in Japan about the lost decade, the 90s and the lost two decades in the 2000s. An awful lot of that was stagnant population growth. Now we're looking at Europe, and they're going into the same type of situation where their populations are stagnating. And in fact, in some instances, dropping, and it's causing growth rates over there that are, you know, in the 1% range, simply because labor force is critical to growth. Now, from an individual standpoint, if you are continued to pay your productivity gains, your real incomes will rise. So, you know, individually, that's not necessarily a problem. But if you look at it from a government standpoint, from a social government standpoint, if you can't get that 3 to 3.5% growth rate, it makes providing public services much, much more difficult if in fact, your economy is stagnant.
Is this a worldwide phenomenon? Because
no, it is not a worldwide phenomenon. This is a phenomena in mature economies. Western Europe, United States, Western Europe and Japan have been going through this now for a decade or more. The United States is starting to run into this problem right now.
So we're going to
start to experience what Western Europe and Japan has been experiencing.
So what does that look like? What will that look like here?
It looks like very slow growth. It looks like government being under more pressure to provide services at the current level.
Mm-hmm.
That's really what it looks like. Just take a picture of Europe. And, you know.
And so what's wrong with slow growth? Why does everything have to grow quickly and immensely? What's wrong?
I always teach my students this the very first day of class about economic growth.
Mm-hmm.
I said, you know, when you go home for Thanksgiving and you go to grandma's house and you got this nice 9-inch pie and there are 8 family members and you cut it all into equal slices and you all get 1/8 of the pie.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you're not satisfied with that one eighth. You want more pie, but if the pie shell, if the pie is still 9-inch pie, for you to get a bigger piece than your 1/8 slice, somebody else has to get a smaller piece. Now, just imagine if the pie grows from 9 inches to 10 inches. Everybody can get a bigger piece. And so that's really what the benefits of economic growth provide you. It allows everybody to get a bigger piece of the pie without anybody else getting a smaller piece.
But there are fewer people. There will be fewer people. When the baby boomers retire and finally die, there will be fewer people. So there'll be more of the
years,
pie.
That's not you know, weeks away. That's decades away.
Yeah, okay.
Okay. And so in the interim, the next 20 or 30 years, they're not going to die. And as not die in large enough numbers to create this is what's – I mean, look, when you look at the budget numbers for the United States, the deficit numbers, and you see that, you know, in 2 years they're all the way down to like a $388 billion budget deficit, which mm-hmm. is inconsequential given we've had $1.5 trillion deficits in recent years. And you go, well, geez, the government's getting their act under control. But then you look out at the CBO numbers that come out after 2015 – okay, we get down to below $400 billion, but then they start going up and up and up and up and up. And 8 years out, it's back up to almost $1 trillion. And the reason for that is really incredibly simple. And this is why the burden falls on government of a slow-growth economy. When baby boomers drop out of the labor force and they're replaced by a smaller group and you get slower growth, yet they're collecting services, Social Security and Medicare. And that's what's going to be driving these budget deficits. Not the weak economy, but baby boomers collecting these entitlements that they've paid into for the last 40 years. And there are 77 million of them. And over the next 15 years, virtually all of them are going to wind up retiring.
But didn't they pay in? And wasn't that money kept in a lockbox?
You know it wasn't,
John?
Mike. Come on. We don't have to go down that road again. Everybody listening knows that's a pay. Both of those are pay-as-you-go programs. And despite the on-books trust fund of Social Security is $6 trillion, nobody could find it if they're
– And the ramifications of this, it seems to me, have tentacles throughout the economy, particularly with regard to housing. We already know that millennials and other younger people don't particularly want to live in the suburbs. They'd rather live in the city. They don't particularly want to buy houses. They want to live in – they want to rent. At least that's the trend at this stage
well,
of their
you know,
lives.
Again, that's economically driven to some extent.
And we have all this housing that came up in the 80s and 90s and early 2000s, all this new housing that was driven by this remarkable growth that we had. If you're reducing the number of working people and older people, the baby boomers who bought these houses are moving into retirement facilities or downsizing, who's going to occupy, who's going to buy all
well,
these houses?
You kind of alluded to it a little earlier when you talked about immigration reform. And we think of this as a political issue as it relates to our southern neighbors and illegal immigration across the Mexican border from Mexico and the rest of Central America. Mm-hmm. And that seems to be our focus. Unfortunately, our focus ought to be more on, you know, what a lot of us fail to remember is that before the 20th century, we had unlimited immigration. And the reason we had unlimited immigration was our limiting economic factor in the 19th century in this country was labor force.
Right.
We just didn't have enough labor force for all the resources. Well, we're starting to run into that area again. And we have quotas on immigration, legal immigration by country that really haven't changed very much in years. We have some other types of programs that let a few people in, like we've got the H-1 visa program for very technical, skilled people. But that's a small program. 100, 125,000 people a year come in on the H-1 visas.
Will this push the recalcitrant Congress into making new policies?
Well, you know, at some point in time, somebody's going to wake up, but I don't think it's going to happen in a year or two, mm-hmm. and start to look at immigration and enlightened immigration reform as a solution to our problem and a solution to government's revenue problem if you can grow the labor force effectively.
John Condon is our
guest. Smartly.
We're coming right back. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Actors Theater of Charlotte, presenting the classics of the Mamas and the Papas in the musical Dream a Little Dream, the sound of the 1960s, July 17th to August 9th. Tickets and information at atcharlotte.org. Israelis and Palestinians trade fire in the Gaza Strip as rage over the kidnapping and killing of four teenagers continues to fuel escalating tensions. Diane Rehm and her guests will talk about the situation and what the U.S. can or cannot do to ease that crisis, coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock on The Diane Rehm Show. And if you'd like to join our conversation about the economy, WFAE.org/Charlotte Talks is a great place to start, or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We're coming right back. An extraordinary group of WFAE listeners are making a big difference. Over 2,500 sustaining members provide steady, ongoing support that keeps WFAE strong and independent, ensuring every member of our community has access to the highest quality public radio station available. Thank you, sustainers. You make WFAE happen. Learn more about the power of sustaining membership online at WFAE.org. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. John Connaughton is with us. Dr. John Connaughton, Director of the North Carolina Economic Forecast at UNC Charlotte, the Babson Capital Economic Forecast. And we're talking about the economy and the gyrations of it. In January, our unemployment rate fell below the national rate here in North Carolina for the first time since December of 2007. Is that trend continue?
Well, we're going to probably stay right about the U.S. number, because the U.S. has really dropped considerably in the last month or two. And so, you know, that's, you know, I think that we'll probably be right at the U.S. rate, which, given where we've been for the last 6 years, is good.
Because we were well below the U.S. rate
in July, in July of 2013, that's a year ago.
Right.
The North Carolina rate was the third worst in the country.
So what's happened to make it improve so dramatically in such a short amount of time?
Two things, okay? One thing is that we actually have created quite a few jobs in the second half of 2013 and the first half of this year. But number two is that, and this is going to be unpopular when we say it, and I'm going to be called, you know, uncaring, the reforms that were made in the state in terms of unemployment compensation seem to have taken a number of people off of the roles of being unemployed. They've simply dropped out of the workforce. Now,
does that mean they're not? They're no longer looking for jobs, and they're no longer being compensated for not looking for
jobs?
That is
correct.
So what does that mean? I mean,
well, you know, you can take that one of two ways, and probably both ways have some truth to them. One is that people who legitimately can't find jobs because they were structurally displaced from their jobs are now in very bad shape, obviously, because they've lost their compensation. But it was never a permanent compensation. All right, it only had a 2-year window on it, even in those times. The second thing is that there are a number of people who are simply gaming the system, and we know that for a fact. We've seen this before. There is reasonable economic literature out there that suggests that that takes place. There are what we call border effects. When one state provides much higher benefits than their neighboring states, there's sort of an influx of people in to take advantage of those benefits. And North Carolina had gotten
so little money.
Oh, there's no question about it. I mean, you know, I
why would anybody do that? It's so little money you can barely live on. You can't live on it.
Well, Mike, that's not true. I mean, North Carolina was providing $525 a week in unemployment compensation.
Could you live on that?
Well, that's not the question. There are, I mean, when you look at that, you know, that's $25,000 a year, plus that you again qualify for other things like food stamps, the SNAP program. You qualify for probably Medicaid as well, and so there are a number of benefits that you get on top of that, and so it creates, I would say, close to a living wage. You're certainly above the poverty line, and so, you know, would you want to live on that? No. But there are many, many, many people that are living on that level. And so, you know, it's a pretty – but the point is, Mike, you compare that 525 to our neighbors to the south, west, and north who are paying more in the mid-three range.
Right.
And you see the difference. I mean, I have a choice. I can live on 525 a week, or I can live on 375 a week. I'm going to go with a 525 a week. If all it does is move, you know, 60 miles south, 60 miles east, or 60 miles north across the border. And so that's part of what's been going on as well.
And you said that we created jobs. How did we create these jobs? How are they created?
Called private business. They expand and they add new employees. And so we've seen that take place last year and this year.
And the reason for the need for that expansion was?
Consumer spending is still going up. Even in the first quarter of this year, consumer spending went up. Even though the overall economy was down by 2.9%, consumer spending was up 1% in real terms domestically. And so, you know, businesses are seeing increases in demand for products and opportunities. Now, it's not the level that we'd like to see. We're not generating the jobs that, you know, everybody would like to see, but we're still generating increased demand and, as a result, jobs.
Consumer spending is up because consumer confidence is up, because people now have jobs, because why?
Yes. Yeah. Consumer confidence is... The normal number is 90. It got as low as 25 during the Great Recession at some points in time. It's back in the low 80s right now. It's not great, but consumers are. But the good news is, for the last year or so, it's been pretty darn stable around there. People are still a little weary, but they're not. Oh my god. They're cautious.
Because of the unexpected wobble in the economy nationally, which includes North Carolina, of course, in the first quarter, these numbers may no longer hold true. But the 2013 GSP, gross state product, increased 2.3% over the 2012 level. You've predicted a 1.9% increase this year over 2013 rates.
Mm-hmm.
Are you still looking at that?
Yes.
And is that a good rate of improvement, or is it anemic?
Yeah, I 3 months ago, we were looking at a little over 2%, mm-hmm. and as a result of the first quarter, we're now back down to 1.9%. I still think that'll be the case, but again, I've got to reiterate that, you know, we remember our target is somewhere in the 3% range, and so we're still well below that. So yeah, the economy is growing. That's the good news. The bad news is it's really not growing very, very robustly, and so we will create jobs. We will get all the jobs back that we lost in this recession by the end of this year, early next year,
okay,
in the state. But you know, it's still not, you know, feeling all that good. And so I think, you know, we started this conversation off today about
if it's not feeling good, why is there consumer confidence?
But again, normal's 90. We're in the 80s, right?
Okay.
So consumers aren't dumb, okay? They get it. They know that, yeah, things are okay, but they're not great.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think they're going to be great anytime soon. I think that, you know, there was a term that was coined at the beginning of this thing called the new normal.
The new normal, yes.
And a lot of us scoffed at it, myself included. And when you start putting things together right now, 6.5 years later, the new normal starts to sound like, you know what? Somebody may have been onto something in terms of it's going to be a slower, more cautious, conservative economy.
This is very scary when I hear an economist say that he scoffed at the new normal, and now maybe those people who didn't know as much as I know were right. That's kind of scary.
It's kind of scary, but I mean, the fact of the matter is that, you know, after 6.5 years of this, I'd call it conservative consumerism on the part of the public.
Right.
And the fact that I really don't see, because of a variety of factors, growth much above 2.5% in the next several years, you know, I think it's going to continue on. People are going to be cautious. They're going to make wise purchases. They're not going to – they've been able to – one of the great things about this cycle has been consumers have been able to deleverage. And they've walked away from this thing with far less debt as a proportion of their income, far less debt payments as a proportion of their, you know, weekly and monthly income. And there's been virtually no change in that over the past year, year and a half, once they got it down to historically low levels. So the deleveraging basically has put consumers in a place where I think they're comfortable, and they're not going to go through that, you know, using the second mortgages as
right.
their ATM machine.
Right.
I think I think those days are gone for some time. And so I think that 2.5% growth is to quote a movie from several years ago, as good as it gets.
Well, Jimmy in Charlotte writes, I don't believe any numbers coming from a government source. A booming stock market is just the product of the Fed printing billions in funny money every month. With no changes in this corrupt do-nothing for the 99% Congress, the credit bubble will burst again. When I took econ at UNC Charlotte, we learned that human greed drives economies and little else.
Well, I think it was Wall Street, Michael Douglas, who said greed is good. Remember Gordon Gekko?
Right.
And we all scoffed at that. I think the last sentence is probably true. It is greed that drives. We all want to get ahead, and that tends to drive us. As far as the Fed is concerned, there is some issues.
Are they printing billions of dollars in funny money every month?
It's actually a whole lot, unfortunately, a lot more complicated than that, and it's hard to describe on radio. But we'll give some figures out and see what you think about this. Two things the Fed has been doing during this recession and recovery. One is keeping interest rates low. We all know about that. Their target rate is for the short term is between 0 and 0.25%. And they've said they're going to extend that for at least another year or so. And my guess is that given a lot of things that are going on, that's their guarantee. They're actually probably going to extend it even further than that. The second thing they're doing, which was unique to this recovery, and they will argue that they've been doing it because of the inactivity at the federal government level in terms of a second stimulus package, a fiscal policy that could have juiced the economy a little bit, because that was never forthcoming. And the first one was badly designed and was not as effective as it could have been for the $800 billion that it spent. They have been engaged in something they call quantitative easing, which is essentially buying up longer-term bonds, both public treasuries, but also mortgage bonds to try to get the mortgage market going.
Right.
The Fed balance sheet, that's their assets and liabilities, was roughly $500 billion or $500 billion in 2007. Today, it's pushing $4 trillion. So, and by the time QE3 is over with and they wind it all down, they're tapering it now, it'll probably be close to $4.5 trillion. All right. It's not going back to $500 billion. The Fed's going to keep $2.5 trillion on its balance sheet going forward forever. The question is, and this is probably to some extent weaved into the question that your listener sent us, how does the Fed effectively get rid of $2 trillion of bonds, both mortgage bonds and government treasury bonds? Mm-hmm. How quickly can they do it? What impact does it have? Does it chew up capacity in the private sector going forward? Do they lose money if rates rise and they've got low-rate bonds they've got to sell at a discount? Does the Fed lose money? Who picks up that? It's very complicated and really hasn't been, I don't think, adequately addressed. So there is some concern out there with the ability of the Fed to effectively and without loss or without a big loss trim the size of their balance sheet back from $4.5 trillion down to $2.5 trillion over the next several years. There isn't a plan out there that I'm aware of.
Also scary.
A little bit.
When interest rates are low, that's very bad news for investors. It's very good news.
People on fixed income, it's particularly bad.
Very bad news for them. Very good news for people who want to borrow money. And it seems to have been good news. It should be good news for the housing market, where interest rates are at near historical lows, at least.
But the problem, Mike, is that you've still got and that we're working our way through, and we're pretty close to getting rid of all that distressed housing that's been out there.
Right.
Now, a lot of it got bought by speculative investors who are renting it and then going to, when prices start to rise, sell it off. Okay.
However,
we're still confronted with a very cautious public that even though we've seen a year now where housing prices have risen on a double-digit basis, and it seems to be sustainable, consistent, that prices are now going up, you would think there'd be a big switch turn and consumers' attitudes towards buying houses would change, i.e., okay, used to be if I bought a house now, and if I waited, it would be cheaper. Now, if I wait, it's going to be more expensive, and probably interest rates are going up. But they're saying, you know what, I'm okay where I am. Or in the case of some millennials, as you're talking about, I just soon rent. I don't want to get in this race. I'll just rent and, you know, take it day to day.
Is that a mistake?
I think long term it's a mistake. Maybe short term it isn't, but I think long term it is. For most Americans, particularly middle class Americans, their largest single investment and their largest single piece of their wealth is their house.
And when interest rates are so low, when you buy a house, you're not just buying the structure, you're buying the mortgage. You're buying the money to pay for the house. Mm-hmm. And with interest rates being so low, are you being short-sighted if you're young when you can get into a mortgage much cheaper than today than you probably will be able to in 5 years?
Yes, but I understand why not. And a lot of it's got to do with job insecurity. Mm-hmm. And you know, I think that and the new normal. I think two things are going on. People are cautious,
right,
and they saw what happened to millions of Americans when their housing prices dropped and they got upside down on the loans and one of the family members lost their job. Second thing is, you know, there's this idea that how long am I going to have this job, even if times continue? Am I going to be moving around, et cetera? And trying to sell houses, as you know, in the last 4 or 5 years, their experience, what they see out there are houses going on the market and staying on forever.
Right.
And we haven't seen that change. It's going to be more than just a couple of years of price increases in houses
I read somewhere that nationally homes over $1 million are selling well. So what does that tell us?
Well, again, let's back away from that a little bit. I know that sounds like, you know, if you live in Charlotte, my goodness, that's the 1%. In California, in Boston, mm-hmm, in New York, that's not the 1%.
Right, okay? Exactly.
And,
right.
And those are the markets that are super hot right now, Washington, D.C., et cetera, and where you're seeing houses in the million-dollar range selling hotly.
And in those markets, those houses are not mansions.
No.
They're small houses. We have 30 seconds. Inflation has not been an issue in the longest time that we've been talking. Do you see it continuing that way?
Yes, I do. I don't see anything in the near term. When you've got 2% growth in the economy, I don't care how much money the Fed's printing and what size the budget deficit is, inflation is not going to be an issue.
So you see kind of a slow growth North Carolina economy where things are not going to get worse, but they're not going to get that much better that much quicker.
The new normal.
I'm holding you to that. Dr. John Connaughton from UNC.
I'll be sorry I said that.
That's right. UNC Charlotte, Director of the Babson Capital, North Carolina Economic Forecast. Thank you for the hour.